This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Monica Ricks. The polls are now closed in Russia, where President Vladimir Putin is expected to win another six-year term. But former CBS Moscow bureau chief Beth Noble tells us many there staged symbolic protests.
There are still plenty of Russians who oppose President Putin and his war in Ukraine, and many of those people bravely showed up in silent protest called by the opposition, which asked people to come to their local polling station at noon and just stand there. And thousands did.
Well, he was on board in 2016 and 2020, but former Vice President Mike Pence told Face the Nation today he's jumped off the Trump train for 2024.
I mean, for me, the reason why I won't endorse Donald Trump this year is because I see him departing from the mainstream conservative agenda that has defined the Republican Party over the last 40 years and still has the best hope for the future of the country.
Meantime, President Biden met with Catholic leaders for St. Patty's Day brunch today at the White House.
Our mother, Catherine Eugenia Finnegan Biden, used to say, Joey, and I mean this is what she'd say repeatedly, as long as you're alive, you have an obligation to strive, and you're not done until seeing the face of God, so keep moving. That was her expression, for real.
Both Biden and Trump taking the day off campaigning ahead of more primaries this week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says another round of hostage talks are underway now in the Middle East.
Hamas's outlandish demands, and I'm not itemizing every one of them now, makes that deal a lot more difficult. But we're going to keep on trying because we want those hostages back.
But he tells CNN that he's not open to early elections in his country. Reporter Lynn Gradstein.
The demonstrators in both Jerusalem and Tel Aviv blocked roads and clashed with police as they demanded new elections in Israel. Netanyahu has repeatedly said there should be no elections during a war. He also said that an Israeli operation in the southern city of Rafah, where almost 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering, could begin in weeks.
A man will be extradited back to Pennsylvania to face murder charges after getting detained in New Jersey. CBS Philadelphia reporter Madeline Wright.
For about 6 hours, they believed Gordon was barricaded inside, possibly with hostages. At one point, they used a ladder to evacuate residents through a second-story window.
However, unbeknownst to law enforcement, the suspect had fled the scene before a perimeter was set up.
Police caught up with Gordon a few blocks away.
He wasn't really fighting, but he kept getting up a few times. But they got him on the ground, and then they all just jumped on him and just arrested him.
He's accused of killing 3 people. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new report says Black LGBTQ plus youth are seeing more equality, but it doesn't always mean greater opportunity. Edwin J. Vieira explains.
The Human Rights Campaign reports around 82% of kids were out to someone in their immediate family. This shows a growing comfort level they have in being who they are, but the findings also indicate this doesn't always translate into acceptance and leads to concern. Ryan J. Watson, a University of Connecticut professor and researcher for the report, says a key takeaway is how Black LGBTQ plus youth face exclusion on several fronts.
Maybe their Black African-American relatives, friends, are in particularly unsupportive of them being a sexual gender minority, and so they kind of have stigma from that side. And then also the kids in this report are reporting they feel excluded by white LGBTQ youth and populations.
The report suggests parents can educate themselves about sexuality and gender identity, as well as use the name and pronouns their kids use to define themselves. The report also finds mental health is a big concern for this population. Around 59% of Black LGBTQ plus youth screened positive for depression, while close to 40% of those surveyed were diagnosed with anxiety. Watson finds these figures alarming.
We could leverage health professionals, teachers, parents, but if I were developing an intervention right now to help a particular group of youth, this to me seems like a population in dire need.
Nearly half of all Black transgender or gender expansive youth have unmet mental health needs. Surveys find accessing mental health care is a challenge for many Black or minority residents. Along with this, many are concerned about how their gender identity will affect their futures. More than 80% say they want to attend college, but almost one-third worry how being LGBTQ+ could harm their future higher education opportunities. This is Edwin J. Vieira. Support for this reporting is provided by Lumina Foundation.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Monday on Nightlight, I'm live in Madison and joined in studio by musician James Runday. It's Nightlight from 7 to 9 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some light snow is possible, otherwise mostly cloudy with highs in the mid-30s. A little breezy at times. For tonight, mostly cloudy, 24. Partly sunny and a high near 38 on your Monday. Tuesday, warmer and windy with a high near 52. Sunny and 40 on Wednesday.
Right now, it's 28.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
News desserts of the week. Here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel, and this is Morning Cannolis. It is our weekly review, our analysis, our examination, our talking with you about these major stories in our lives, statewide, nationally, and sometimes throughout the world, every single Saturday morning here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about those areas of government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America and worldwide that animate our lives. Thank you so much for being with me this morning for this hour and hopefully the second hour too on our Saturday morning broadcast. It is Saturday, March 16th, 2024. This is our 89th broadcast on these Civic Media stations statewide and in other places throughout our country as well. We're going to be talking about that at the end of the second hour. We've got a very special programming note coming up about the future of this broadcast. We're not going away. We're going to be restyling and recrafting somewhat to ensure that our goals, that is in the areas of government law and aspiration of justice, are further met and further advanced as a result of our discussions here every Saturday morning. As always, we are encouraging this morning your questions, your inquiries about the subject matters on our syllabus for this day. That number, as always, is 844-967-2789. Once again, that's 844-967-2789. My excellent producer, Johnny, and I are here in the studios of WAUK in Waukesha to take those calls, those inquiries of yours, and to get you on the air talking with me about those significant things in our lives. As always, this morning we have an ambitious, very ambitious, but nonetheless achievable agenda. I'm going to talk with you in just a moment or so about what that syllabus is all about. We ask three simple questions. What happened? Why are those things relevant? And what options do we have in response to them? What is on our agenda for this morning? Lots of things happening in the areas of government and rule of law and justice just in the past 24 hours, 48 hours, certainly throughout this past week. It has been a big news week when it comes to these important issues of government operation and law in America. We're going to be doing some geography, going right down the East Coast in this, our first hour, and probably a bit into our second hour as well. We're going to talk about cases in New York, then also in Georgia, and then also in Florida. And you know what those are. You know about the status of the state case, the so-called hush money case, pending right now in a Manhattan criminal courtroom. I'm going to talk about what happened just yesterday and why it's going to certainly prompt a change in the scheduling of the trial in that matter. I'm going to go south then to Georgia, two major events on Thursday and Friday of just this past week, one of them involving some of the dismissal of charges in that omnibus RICO indictment against Donald Trump and others. And then, almost as significant, the decision by the judge there not to disqualify the prosecutor, but to require that her deputy, the fellow who is principally in charge of prosecuting the case, that he no longer be a part of that. We're going to talk about what the judge said. We're going to do some microscopic justice once again, going deep into the specifics of what the judge in that case said and did, the reasons for his decision. And in all three of these areas, including the Mar-a-Lago case, we'll be doing some analysis about where these cases come from, what the decisions mean, and what we can anticipate for the future. Again, in New York and in Georgia and in Florida, all those cases, three of the four major criminal cases pending against the former president, a present candidate for the presidency. His name, of course, is Donald Trump. And then into our second hour, we're going to go back to, as we often do, the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, which issued two, although related, decisions yesterday in the area of social media. We have talked about this a lot in the past, that one of the major focuses of our United States Supreme Court in this 2023-2024 term has been on social media and the interaction between it and you and government. Two major cases, basically the same opinion authored by Amy Coney Barrett, released just yesterday, having to do with this connection between government officials and the media, social media in particular, things that are out there posted on social media. We'll talk about that. And then, as I said, at the end of the second hour, a significant programming note about what you're going to be hearing going forward on our 90th broadcast beginning next Saturday. We'll tell you more about that at the end of our second hour this morning on our broadcast. Thank you once again for joining Johnny and me for our discussion. And let us launch right into that ambitious agenda this morning by beginning in Manhattan. Big news coming out just yesterday, March 15th. A New York judge, his name is Juan Merchan, who is presiding over the so-called catch and kill or hush money case. This is the case involving criminal charges against Donald Trump, alleging that right before the 2016 election, he basically violated New York law in failing to properly account for, describe transactions, financial transactions operated through his fixer, Michael Cohen, by which he paid off a porn star named Stormy Daniels, and caught that case, killed it through the National Enquirer, a fellow named David Pecker, and prevented us, at least for that time, from hearing all about that. The allegation is less about the salacious nature of that relationship, but rather a violation of New York state law. And as we said last week, when we talked a lot about the categories of things that Alvin Bragg, who is the district attorney there, he's the prosecutor in that case, the things he's going to be presenting, yes, he's going to talk about that financial transaction, but he's also going to talk about the setting in which it happens and describe these other things that also happened with a second woman also being paid off, a doorman being paid off, the Access Hollywood tape, all those kinds of things that were happening at the same time, telling this overall story, what I have described as Donald Trump's origin story when it comes to attempts to undermine, to affect the election in America. He is going to describe the fact that this case, like the others, most of the others, is at least at a minimum, also about election interference. Why? Because the allegations go to that fundamental theme that Alvin Bragg is going to be presenting during the course of the trial, that Donald Trump, by doing this, by paying people off, by violating thereby New York law, he effectively prevented us from understanding fully who he is as a candidate, and therefore attempted to interfere with the election, the campaign at that time. What happened? What happened just yesterday? Well, in order to understand what happened yesterday in the context of that prosecution, we need to go back and understand that the judge, Juan Merchan, who is the trial judge who's presiding over this proceeding in his courtroom, has scheduled this case to go ahead. Jury selection beginning on March 25th. Yes, that's right. That's 9 days from today, the end of this month. Judge Merchan had indicated that he is going to begin jury selection on that day, a date that's been on his calendar for a long time. And now with all of the other trials, as we've talked about previously, all of them highly unlikely going to be going ahead at any time in the near future. Doubtful they will even see the light of day in this calendar year. Juan Merchan said, let's go ahead and try this case. And indeed, Alvin Bragg said, yes, ready to go. And the plan was to do just that until maybe not full stop, but a considerable stop happened just yesterday. Again, we need to go back to understand how it is that this happened. During the course of any criminal case, including in the state of New York, in this Manhattan courtroom, there is a statutory, a legal, a constitutional obligation for prosecutors to present to the defense all of the information that has been gathered during the course of the investigation to ensure that the defendant has a full and complete opportunity to review all the things the government is going to be presenting during the course of the trial. That includes witness statements. That includes reports of interviews. That includes forensics evidence, photographs, other things that might be used during the course of the prosecution, even things that may not see the light of day. All of that is required in the federal system. We've got statutory authority for that. There are cases called Jenks and Brady that also impose upon federal prosecutors the obligation, the rightful, the constitutional obligation to produce information, to produce that information so that a defendant, in this case, Donald Trump, can properly defend himself against the charges brought against him. That is a fundamental concept. It is what animates our system. It's what I lived by and embraced for 30 years of my practice doing criminal work in the Federal District Court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. It makes sense, and it is a part of our fundamental system of the rule of law. And so what happens here? As a result of the prosecution, the announcement of the charges, which I just described involving this hush money case brought by the district attorney promptly turns over all the information that he and his staff, investigators, have gathered about this particular charge, supporting and also arguably exculpating the defendant for conduct in which he is allegedly involved. That's a part of the process. And as a part of that, in June of last year, Alvin Bragg reached out where? To the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. Reached down Manhattan, if you will, and reached into a federal room, the room of the U.S. Attorney there, and said, I know that in the past, 2008, you investigated a case involving the same set of facts. And during the course of that, not only did you prosecute and ultimately convict this fellow named Michael Cohen, but you also did other things that pursued these allegations that there was a federal violation based upon the same fundamental facts. And Alvin Bragg appropriately said, I want those materials. I want you to give those to me so that I can produce those to the defendant in my state case. That's proper to do. And that's what he did. And the U.S. Attorney's Office back in the summer of last year produced some, heavy emphasis on some, of those documents. Came back and said, here's what we've got. And Alvin Bragg repeatedly, in that connection, did turn over the documents that were produced to him by the U.S. Attorney's Office, had done that previously, did it again now. And then in January of this year, the defense, on behalf of Donald Trump, served its own subpoena upon the U.S. Attorney's Office for the same kinds of things, presumably. Now, we don't know exactly what those requests and what the subpoena looked like, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about what happened in the wake of the defense subpoena of the U.S. Attorney's Office and how that affected the scheduling of the trial right after this break. Discussion following about the status of that criminal case in Manhattan.
Is the Shaw WAUK. The Maggie Dawn Show.
How to avoid this apocalyptic nightmare? It's to vote. Because at the end of the day, the only thing that will save our democracy is our democracy. America, make your voice heard. Turn away from authoritarianism and vote this November.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass, eyes waiting, started to wonder. Metamorphosis, philosopher you thought you is.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
You're listening to The Shaw at WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Back talking this morning in these first segments of our first hour on our Saturday morning broadcast, all about the status of this case that was scheduled to go to trial a week from Monday in a Manhattan criminal courtroom, a state criminal courtroom, and the decision by the judge necessitated by events to postpone that proceeding. Let's talk more about what prompted that decision by Juan Merchan, the judge who's presiding over that case, right before the break, telling you about the process by which a defendant is constitutionally, statutorily entitled to get documents as a part of the prosecution and the defense of the case. Again, a defendant not required under the law to produce anything to defend himself or herself, itself under our Constitution, presumed innocent until proven guilty, not obliged to do anything. But yes, indeed, the prosecution not only has the burden of proving the case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury unanimously, but also to produce materials, information, so that the defendant has a complete sense of what is going on in the case, what he or she or it is going to hear during the course of the trial. And again, Alvin Bragg did that in connection with his own investigative materials, made a request to the U.S. Attorney's Office, also there in Madison, in Manhattan, and asked them for all the materials that they had in connection with their own discreet investigation back in 2008 of the same events. And that corpus of material also relevant because, of course, inside that federal investigation was a lot of information about an individual named Michael Cohen, who was ultimately convicted for that and other things in the federal court. And he, of course, is a major witness in this state case now on the state docket of Judge Juan Merchan. And so the information relevant, and Alvin Bragg gets the initial tranche of materials, turns those over to the defendant. And again, in January of just this year, the defense files and submits to the U.S. Attorney's Office what could arguably be called a follow-up and maybe even somewhat duplicative request. We haven't seen the specific language of their subpoena, but they asked for the same set of materials, and lo and behold, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan comes forward and produces about 100,000 pages of records. And that coming out, of course, in the last couple of weeks or so, more materials apparently coming down the road, 100,000 documents, presumably not previously seen by Alvin Bragg, not previously produced through this system, which I previously described right now. And as a result of that, appropriately, the defendant says, wait a minute, we are ready to go to trial in 9 days. I'm just getting now 100,000 documents that I've not previously seen. How can I prepare my defense? And in this particular case, when a defendant comes forward and says, I do not have sufficient time, given the timing of the clock and the movement forward on this trial, Donald Trump's lawyers are right. Donald Trump's lawyers are right to say we need more time to look at all of this information. Now, as a practical matter, do we live in a time when all of these materials are produced in banker's boxes the old way when I first started as a prosecutor to produce them? The answer is no. It's all done electronically. And yes, indeed, there are systems in place for ensuring that defendants and prosecutors and other people involved in the case on both sides can do word searches, can do analysis of documents. It is no longer the case that as a lawyer, as a prosecutor, defense attorney, I need to sit down and go through each one of those banker's boxes in great detail and identify every single document, read every single document. But I do want to find out what is there. And so, again, electronics will help me a whole lot in doing that, word searches, those kinds of things. But there may be some documents. And indeed, Alvin Bragg has confirmed that among those 100,000 documents, there is a subset that is fairly relevant to this, focusing again upon Michael Cohen. And certainly, if you're the defense attorneys in these cases responding to what the prosecution has provided to you, you want to read those documents yourself. And don't want to rely upon an electronic system just to tell you what they say. It is important as a part of your defense. And so what happens in this particular case? These materials coming in, 73,000 pages of records initially, 31,000 additional documents also dropped as a result of this. Some subset of those apparently highly relevant to this case. As a result of this, Donald Trump's lawyers say, Judge, we can't go ahead in 9 days, 10 days from now. We've got to review all these materials as a part of our defensive preparation to ensure that there is, in fact, a defense to be made. If there are some things in this material, this tranche material that we need to take a look at, we need to prepare for that. And indeed, they're right about that. And what happens, of course, is they file then a motion for an extension, a delay in the trial. They're seeking 90 days, 3 months, which again, depending upon what those 100,000 documents say, may or may not be unreasonable. Alvin Bragg has come back and said, well, not all of them are relevant. How about 30 days? 30 days is what he's proposing. And oh, by the way, the Trump attorneys are also saying, Judge, you need to dismiss this case. Why? Because of these pretrial antics, as they describe them, of the government, the failure of between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Alvin Bragg DA's office to produce these documents, all of that renders it impossible for us to defend against this case. Also claiming that for that reason, the case should be dismissed outright, outright dismissal, which could be one of the remedies on Judge Merchan's agenda, although highly, highly likely. What has he done? Well, he has said that I'm going to delay the case right now for 30 days beyond March 25th. And so we know it's not starting on March 25th. What we do know, however, that on that morning, on Monday morning, March 25th, he's going to call everybody in and he is going to say to them, what is going on here? I had this scheduled. We're all ready to go. And now we're getting additional documents this late in the process. This case has been charged for a year and discovery should have been undertaken and pursued and exchanged long before now. What is going on here? He has asked them to provide a detailed timeline of the events leading up to this recent disclosure. Tell us what happened exactly during the course of this process. And he has also said that he will set a new trial date if necessary after the hearing. He said he wants his detailed timeline and also sought the correspondence with federal prosecutors who recently turned over these records, including letters and subpoenas and emails and notes and messages. He's trying to get to the bottom of what happened to derail this trial. He is not happy, plainly, and I suspect we're going to be hearing about this from the judge on March 25th. Alvin Bragg has got to be upset about this as well because his federal counterparts, again, federal prosecutors, not state prosecutors, now disclosing weeks, days before the trial, all this information. We don't know if Alvin Bragg had it before, presumably not, or he would have disclosed it. But that is the circumstance that brings us to this situation where the trial long anticipated, the one trial that might have gone ahead this calendar year, now suspended again and likely going to be suspended for at least 30 days, if not longer. Again, my own assessment is that 90 days may not be an inappropriate amount of time, given what has happened here. 100,000 documents, as I said before, probably not all of them relevant, but relevant to a defense, you bet it is. Why? Because a lot of that has to do with Michael Cohen. Who is Michael Cohen? He is going to testify predominantly during the course of this trial about the very transactions that allegedly resulted in this violation of New York law. For that reason, all of this relevant as we now look to March 25th and down the road for the rescheduling of this trial pending in the Manhattan court. When we come back, we're going to go south to Georgia, spend a lot of time talking about other developments of just this past week in the parallel but different criminal investigation going on there.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
CBS News Brief. No surprise, President Vladimir Putin has won re-election in Russia, with early returns showing Putin winning nearly 88% of today's vote. Former CBS Moscow Bureau Chief Beth Noble.
I expect President Putin will be able to continue any current policy and claim that his people support it, whether it's confrontation with NATO and the West or stepping up the crackdown on dissent at home.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he is not open to early elections as its war rages on with Hamas.
I think the only government that we should be working on to bring down now is the terrorist tyranny in Gaza, the Hamas tyranny.
Netanyahu on CNN today. Thousands are now protesting for those elections in Israel. And a warning to TikTok users from Illinois Democrat Raja Krishnamurthy.
It's legal now, but I would ask everyone to exercise caution with regard to the app.
He was on Face the Nation after backing a bill to ban that app. CBS News Brief.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Packers say so long to Aaron Jones. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It happened this past week after contract talks broke down. The Packers signed 26-year-old running back Josh Jacobs from the Raiders, then called 29-year-old Aaron Jones to tell him he was being released. Jones then signed the next day with the Vikings and was asked for his reaction.
It's a part of the business. You know what you sign up for. My agent had called me before all of that happened, telling me it was a possibility. So, you know, my mind was already prepared, and I just wanted to go where I felt wanted.
Josh Jacobs is now in Green Bay and talked about being Jones' replacement.
Yeah, I actually know Aaron, you know, so I already know what kind of guy he is. You know what I'm saying? A great dude, man. And obviously, he's a legend around here just from what he's done in his time. I don't really consider myself coming in and, you know, like replacing what he's done. I just try to hold that standard.
That's Packers running back Josh Jacobs. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some light snow is possible, otherwise mostly cloudy with highs in the mid-30s. A little breezy at times. For tonight, mostly cloudy, 24. Partly sunny and a high near 38 on your Monday. Tuesday, warmer and windy with a high near 52. Sunny and 40 on Wednesday.
Right now, it's 28.
If it's your turn to host a game, Grandpa's Barbecue suggests you try something different. Put out the perfect barbecue flavor of Grandpa's Barbecue. Add it to your ribs, dip the meatballs, or drench your wings in the original flavor of Grandpa's Barbecue. It isn't too hot or spicy, fruity or smoky or whatever. Grandpa's Barbecue. Available in select stores and online at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm. Built for real life.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
All about the status of cases involving current presidential candidate Donald Trump, former president of the United States of America. And in our first segments, talking about what happened in Manhattan just this past week as a result of the late disclosure of a tranche of documents, 100,000 documents coming out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. That's the district that previously, under the prior administration, had investigated the same fact scenario that is now the subject of a state prosecution pending there in the Manhattan District Court in front of Judge Juan Merchan. And the takeaway from this is a lot of explaining to do. The district attorney himself, obviously concerned about this, had said in an abundance of caution appropriate to have some delay accomplished to ensure the defense has an opportunity to review these materials. The defense, of course, saying, no, we need 90 days, not just 30 days. And indeed, because of the misbehavior, the misconduct, as they allege it, by the prosecution, the failure to produce these documents in a more timely fashion, because of that, the entire case should be dismissed. Now, unlikely that Juan Merchan is going to do that on March 25th, but he is going to ask some piercing questions about exactly what happened, and indeed he should. There is some responsibility here on the side of the DA for getting this material. There's a huge amount of responsibility here. And beyond that, there is some explaining that needs to be done coming out of my own former agency, the U.S. Department of Justice. Why are these materials being produced now for the first time when we've known about the pendency of the prosecution for well over a year? What happened? And inside the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland also has some explaining to do, as does the U.S. attorney there, for why the delay happened. Why is it that just upon a subpoena from the defense, which they can do, why now are these materials being produced for the first time? It is a cause of great concern, not only for the scheduling of the trial, which, again, is going to be pushed back arguably months. And as I've said before, every time a trial is delayed, other things can happen. And so today, where there is no certainty about exactly when this trial is going to be conducted, when jury selection will begin, all kinds of things can happen between the time of a prosecution initiation and the course of discovery, even the setting of a trial date. Witnesses change, positions changed, counsel changes, all kinds of things, facts and circumstances can develop and be disclosed that will prompt a further delay. We don't know what's happening in the future, but this is an example of the kinds of things that can, in fact, do happen, not without explanation, which is what Judge Merchan is going to ask, but they happen, and they result in delays in the prosecution and the defense of cases like this. We will plainly be very attentive here on all the broadcast stations of Civic Media to this trial and others not happening 9 days from now. Let's go south, and let's look to Georgia. We also know there this omnibus, this huge sweeping RICO case, 41 counts, 19 co-defendants initially, huge sweeping indictment returned by an indicting grand jury there, again, a long time ago. Now, like in New York, in the course of pretrial motions, what is that all about? It means that following the return of the indictment, two major things happen. One is the defense has an opportunity to file motions with the judge, as does the prosecution, for ask for various things in connection with the anticipated trial. Motions to suppress, motions to keep evidence out, motions to bring evidence in, all sorts of things related to the validity of the indictment itself, the charges, all sorts of things related to witnesses and forensics evidence, and all kinds of things can happen. All of that written out for the judge, often oral argument in front of judges in this pretrial period to narrow and sift and ensure that when the trial begins, It is focused upon things that are relevant and material. That's what the process is all about in every single one of these cases, including the Manhattan case, and certainly including the omnibus Georgia case brought by Fonnie Willis, who again is the Fulton County District Attorney, returned by a grand jury, an investigative grand jury, and then indicting grand jury, this sweeping RICO charge against Donald Trump and many others. And so what has happened recently? Well, we're going to talk at great length this morning, a microscopic justice analysis of what the judge did with respect to this continuing and pending until just yesterday challenge to Fonnie Willis's continued role as the prosecutor. We're going to get to that in just a moment or so. Even before Scott McAfee, who is the judge in that case, he is the state court judge, who is presiding over that criminal case in Fulton County. Even before that, the day before, the judge quashes 6 charges in that omnibus indictment. Surprising that he did this, but perhaps understandable as you look once again at the decision, the written decision that he issues this decision to dismiss, Scott McAfee does, 6 of the 41 counts against the 19 co-defendants. 4 of them already have pled guilty, as we have talked before, since this grand jury indictment was returned in August. The charge, the fundamental RICO charge remains. That's a racketeering charge brought against all the defendants. And the judge is very clear in his order that those charged based upon overt acts in furtherance of this RICO criminal engagement, that the indictment says the defendants engaged in furtherance of this racketeering conspiracy, the RICO allegations and the overt acts described in the indictment, all of those remain. None of that affected by his decision on Thursday to dismiss 6 other counts. The judge, Scott McAfee, explicit in stating that his order does not apply to those acts, nor does it relate to this qualification issue, which we're going to get to. The 9-page ruling that Judge McAfee does issue in the middle of this week, however, takes aim at charges asserting this, that Donald Trump and other defendants solicited public officials to break the law by violating their oaths of office. That was what's set forth in the indictment. That's the theory upon which these particular counts proceeded. For example, one of those counts against Donald Trump said that he unlawfully solicited, requested, and importuned the Georgia Secretary of State, you know his name well, it's Brad Raffensperger, to violate his oath of office by decertifying the election. That's what one of those counts said. And the judge comes back and says, as to that count and others, which we'll describe in particularity in just a moment, he says these 6 counts contain all the essential elements of the crime, but fail to allege in sufficient detail regarding the nature of their commission, the kinds of things the defendant is entitled to know about, again, as a part of our process. Due process, you're entitled to discovery. The information the government has is going to present against you during the course of the trial. And you're also entitled to know with detail the specific allegations against you in the indictment. The judge, Judge McAfee, writes this. He said these counts, do not give the defendants enough information to prepare their defenses intelligently, as the defendants could have violated the Constitution and thus the statute in dozens, if not hundreds, of distinct ways. That's the judge writing in his 9-page opinion of just this past week. One of those 6 charges, once again, count 28, related to Trump's telephone call. You recognize that already from the description that I read from the indictment. Raffensperger was called by then still President Trump on January 2nd, pressuring the Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn the presidential election results in that state. Another charge, count 38, also now dismissed from this indictment, relates to a letter that Trump sent to Raffensperger in September of 2021, asking him to decertify the Georgia presidential election results or seek similar legal remedies and announce the true winner. That's the basis of count 38. Other counts quashed by the judge also related to these attempts to pressure public officials. 3 counts, those are numbered 2 and 6 and 23 in the indictment, allege that several of these defendants broke the law when they urged Georgia lawmakers to appoint pro-Trump electors after Joe Biden, our current president, actually won the state. Count 5 concerned a call that Trump made to a fellow named David Ralston, R-A-L-S-T-O-N, who was then the Speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives. During that conversation, according to the allegations in the indictment, this count now dismissed, Trump pressed Mr. Ralston to call a special legislative session to appoint new electors. Again, all a part of this theory that's based upon that the defendants soliciting public officials to violate their oath. The judge saying, yeah, you've got the count described and you've got the elements there, but you're not giving specific, sufficient, detailed information upon which the defendant can rely in defending against the case as we go to trial. And so he dismisses those six counts. Now, as I said before, does it accomplish a huge blow? Well, the answer is probably not. Probably not, but it certainly does take away some of the force of this omnibus 41-count indictment, and that leads to the remedies that may be out there. Fannie Willis has three choices here. She can do nothing. She can simply let that stand and not appeal this at all and go to trial without those six counts. Arguably, she's going to tell the same kind of story as those counts described in sort of the speaking indictment, the speaking charges already in those six counts, no longer a part of the prosecution against Donald Trump and the others. She can do nothing and simply go ahead with the case as it has been reduced by Scott McAfee, or she can appeal. She can pursue this to an appellate court and say, you know what, the judge was wrong. And in fact, the counts do, in fact, provide enough information for the defendant to know what it is that he and the others are charged with and seek to overturn Scott McAfee's opinion. Or third, and probably most likely, she can go back to the grand jury. She can go back to the grand jury and say, well, it appears that the judge did not like the language of the indictment as it was returned by the grand jury. We're going to restyle these counts. We're going to add that detail that was not in the first indictment. We're going to ask the grand jury to re-indict on these cases, called a superseding indictment, a follow-up indictment that corrects the problems that the district court judge, the trial judge, identified in his order. That's also a remedy that she has out there, probably one of those that she is considering at the top of her list right now. At some point soon, she will need to identify which one of those three remedies she is going to pursue. Now, that also underscores, again, the grand jury process and how this works. As I've often said on this broadcast, grand juries do, in fact, review the evidence, the testimony, the documents, all the other evidence before them to determine whether there's probable cause. And yes, it is in the end a decision by the grand jury to issue charges. But as a practical matter, as we have also discussed, it is the obligation of the prosecutor, in this case, Fannie Willis. When I was a prosecutor for 30 years as an assistant U.S. attorney with the imprimatur of the U.S. attorney, to draft what it is the grand jury has found, or is finding during the course of their investigation, and present the draft of that to the grand jury to embrace or reject. As I said before, there have been times in my career when a grand jury has gotten back to me and said, you know what, we do not concur, Mr. Santel. We're not going to go ahead with these particular counts. That's their role, but it is the role of the prosecutor. And this is the key here. In this case, Fannie Willis to come forward and say, we've got to remedy the problem with these six counts. And so, grand jury, we're not asking you to make a different determination on probable cause, but we are going to present to you some new language as to these six counts, asking you to supersede, to find probable cause as these offense conduct pieces are now redescribed in the corrective or superseding grand jury. She can do that. Can go back to the grand jury. That's probably what she will do, especially since, unlike the Manhattan case that we described earlier in this broadcast, there is no trial date right now. I know she has talked about wanting to go ahead in August, and the defense plainly has poo-pooed that notion, said, no, this has got to be tried well into 2025. But she's got the opportunity now to go back and remedy that problem. And it's highly likely, again, she'll go back to the grand jury and do just that. But it is undeniably a reflection of the crafting, the drafting that was done on behalf of the grand jury the first time around in this very extensive grand jury indictment. And now Fannie Willis, if she wants to pursue this, needs to go back and correct the errors that her office did on behalf of the grand jury in drafting that initial omnibus indictment the first time around. We'll see what she does, and we'll see what she does when it comes to the future prosecution of this case. We know as well, the other major story coming out just yesterday, that Fannie Willis remains on this case. And when we come back, we're going to go deep into the decision also by Scott McAfee to keep her on that case in exchange for the principal, the lead prosecutor, his name is Nathan Wade, to resign from that prosecution. All that happened yesterday. We're going to talk about it next.
Listening to the Shaw, WAUK.
All eyes will be on Wisconsin when the NFL brings the 2025 player selection draft to the state. 250,000 visitors are expected. Here's Green Bay Mayor Aaron Genrich.
You know, maybe we don't have as many hotel rooms as a Kansas City or a Detroit, but I think it's going to be incredibly positive, not just for Green Bay, but the state as a whole.
It's the second time Wisconsin hosted the draft, the first in 1939. Do you know where? Oshkosh, Milwaukee, or Madison? The answer coming up.
It's really our obligation to pull people out of that campus when the draft activities aren't going on, to make sure that they see all the sites that we have within our downtown and other places.
And with the main draft campus around Lambeau Field, it's a time for the whole area to shine. Now, did you guess the Wisconsin location for the 1939 draft? It was a one-day event in Milwaukee with the NFL championship game the next day. The Packers beat the Giants 27-0. There's a winning slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Show. We are back talking now in this, the final segment of our first hour, getting into depth on the other significant thing that came out of Fulton County just yesterday. This decision, again, by Scott McAfee. Yes, he's the same judge who dismissed those six counts from the indictment, leaving Fannie Willis with some decision-making to do about what she does next with respect to those counts. The other major thing that Scott McAfee did yesterday is release his omnibus order. We're going to spend some time going through it. A 23-page order finding that there is not a basis for Fannie Willis or her office to be disqualified from the future prosecution of this case, thus enabling her to make decisions not only about those six counts, but other things in the future prosecution, the pretrial motions still pending there. But in exchange for that, finding that the principal prosecutor, Special Assistant District Attorney Nathan Wade, hired by Fannie Willis during the course of this proceeding and with whom she had a personal romantic relationship, that he needs to go. And indeed, in the wake of the judge's order of just yesterday, Nathan Wade, the other big news, resigned from that Trump case after the judge's ruling, finding, again, no basis upon which to disqualify the officer, Fannie Willis, but finding an appearance of impropriety. And we're going to get to that, the basis for the decision by Nathan Wade to leave and no longer being part of this, ensuring, if you will, that Fannie Willis, at least for now, has the capacity to go ahead and prosecute the case, but without him. And so what is the basis for this? Again, we're going to spend some time at the last minutes of this segment and then going into our second hour, some deep dive, some microscopic justice analysis of exactly what it is the judge said and what he didn't say about this all-encompassing decision. This challenge is brought by a defendant named Michael Roman, R-O-M-A-N. He's one of the defendants in this case. He's joined by eight other co-defendants who also joined in this motion to disqualify the Fulton County DA's office and the DA in particular on various grounds, and specifically alleging the DA and Wade traveled together on multiple occasions and had other relationships, associated expenses during the course of their not only relationship, but also the time that they were prosecuting this case together. The claims presented, as the judge said, a possible financial conflict of interest for the district attorney. And in the end, as you're going to see as we go through this analysis, he finds that there is not actually, as we have said on this broadcast and others, there actually is not a conflict of interest presented by the defense. the defense motion presented by Roman and the other defendants in this case. What he does say in a second major portion of his order is that there is indeed an appearance of impropriety that necessitates that something be done here. And I would offer the perspective on this, which is that the judge is effectively cleaning up the personnel matters, the admittedly embarrassing, the admittedly probably inappropriate and improper inside the office relationship that should never have gone forward. We'll talk about some of the language that he uses to describe that relationship. What he doesn't say appropriately is that that relationship inside the office, as difficult and challenging as it was and problematic as it is, does not affect the prosecution outside of the office with respect to Donald Trump, doesn't deprive them of any constitutional or statutory rights. And for that reason, no conflict of interest, nothing to support the disqualification of the prosecutor herself, if indeed this principal who prosecutes on her behalf, on behalf of the office, Nathan Wade, if he is no longer a part of this. Fascinating opinion, which we're going to get into as we do just that. A lot of preliminary information set forth again by the judge in his omnibus order, which is readable. It is digestible. I encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't done already just that. He describes the 2.5 days of testimony. Many, if not all of you, remember that well, including testimony of various individuals, including Nathan Wade, including, stunningly, the DA herself takes the stand and describes things related to the relationship and her own conduct. And the court, as it says on this very second page, after having given all the parties exactly what the judge promised, a full opportunity to disclose what they want to disclose, a full opportunity, evidentiary-wise, to argue the case as well, the court finds that the defendants failed, that is a defense, this Mr. Roman and others, failed to meet their burden of proving that the DA acquired an actual conflict of interest, in this case, through her personal relationship and recurring travels with her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade, the financial issues there as well. All the other grounds for disqualification, including forensic misconduct, which we'll also get to, are also denied. He said there's simply no basis for doing any of this. And then goes on to say this on page 2. The established record now highlights, however, a significant appearance of impropriety, distinguishes that from the legal standard of actual conflict of interest, even forensic misconduct, which he also describes troublingly later in the opinion. He says that the significant appearance of impropriety infects the current structure of the prosecution team. Exactly what I'm describing before, this internal issue, the internal structure, the structure of the prosecution team, an appearance that must be removed through the state's selection of one of two options, either to get rid of Mr. Wade, he's got to go, or Fonnie Willis and the DA's office have got to be disqualified. The defense motions, he said, are therefore granted in part, and then proceeds to describe the conflict of interest law in the state of Georgia. And in particular, says that highest courts consistently remind us that prosecutors are indeed held to a unique and exacting professional standard in light of their public responsibility and their power. Got it just right. Prosecutors have this tremendous amount of authority and power and need to wield it on behalf of the people they represent with integrity, with a focus on justice, the rule of law. That's what really animates Alvin Bragg in that Manhattan case to say, you know what? I've got a responsibility to ensure that justice is done here. And yes, indeed, Donald Trump in that case is entitled to some additional time to review this document tranche that's just recently released. And again, the judge here, Scott McAfee, in this unrelated, arguably related around the edges case, says, reminds prosecutors of this high burden that they have when it comes to dealing with and prosecuting cases, and then goes on to say, provides the framework for his decision. He said, the Georgia law says there are two bases upon which to disqualify. Those are conflicts of interest and forensic misconduct. Those are the two generally recognized grounds for disqualification. He cites the law and the authority for that, and that gives rise to the cases that he describes and his resolution, ultimately, of this situation, establishing no disqualification, but an awful lot of criticism of the DA there in Fulton County. Right after the top of the hour break, we're going to get into that in greater detail, reciting what the judge said.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Tune in Monday for the Devil's Advocate. Dom's going to tell you Joe Biden's old. I'm going to tell you, no, he's not. He's just right. Monday, 4 to 6 across the Civic Media Network.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian. Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed at a reasonable hour. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabe from 7 to 9 p.m. on the Shaw, 540 a.m. and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to the Shaw,
WAUK 540 a.m. Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Monica Ricks.